I'm so glad you saw fit to come out tonight. We are about to embark on a 7-part series together entitled Images at War. Images at War. Everyone should have an outline in hand about this time. Tonight's topic is entitled Born to a Battlefield. So make sure you have an outline. There are people who are making them available. So raise your hand if for some reason you were missed. We want to make sure that you're able to follow along and cover the material that we have to go through tonight. This topic is one that I would like to open with you by turning your attention to one of the best-selling books in American history. This book is entitled, maybe you're familiar with the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Has anybody read that book? There's one person who's read it. Have you heard of the book? Yeah, you've heard of the book. It's a very provocative title, isn't it? The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm not going to tell you any of those habits this evening. You're going to have to pursue that on your own. But Stephen Covey deals in this book with paradigms and paradigm shifts. And he tells the story of one of his rather minor paradigm shifts. He says that he was sitting on a subway in New York and quite contented to take his little journey. He was looking over the newspaper. There were no interruptions. There was a nice, calm atmosphere as all the other passengers quietly sat doing their own thing. And then the subway stopped, and a man entered with 3 children. And these children were going ballistic from the moment they stepped on the subway until the subway journey ended for Stephen Covey. They were moving all around, rattling people's papers, jumping on the seats, and the man, the father, Stephen Covey presumed, was sitting there kind of in a daze with no awareness, it seemed, of what his children were doing. Didn't seem to care. And so Stephen Covey bore with this as long as he could, and finally he worked up the courage in the most polite way that he could muster to lean over to the man, and he said, "Sir, your children are disrupting the ride of various passengers." And Stephen Covey says that he was feeling quite frustrated with this man's parenting skills. The man looked at Stephen and said, "You're right, I'm so sorry. I need to get control of them, but I don't know exactly what to do. You see, we've just come from the hospital and their mother died 1 hour ago. And I guess I'm a little distracted." And Stephen says that in that moment, his paradigm shifted. One moment he was feeling frustrated with the man. How could anybody let their kids run around on the subway doing all this stuff and not try to get control of them? But then, in a nanosecond, his emotional state toward the man changed because of additional information. All of a sudden, frustration gave way to, what do you suppose? Sympathy. Compassion. I can't believe that this man and his children have just been through this. And so his paradigm shifted. Now, that's a minor paradigm shift on a personal level. Many paradigm shifts have occurred down through history. There was a time, for example, when human beings believed for hundreds of years that the earth was flat. In fact, some people still think it's flat. Just Google it. Google on your computer Flat Earth Society and you'll find a group of people who still believe the earth is flat and they deny all evidence to the contrary. But for thousands of years, people believed the earth is flat, and in that paradigm, how far would they sail to explore the world? Well, not too far, for fear that they would come to the edge and drop right off into who knows where. And a part of that paradigm included that the who knows where involved dragons and other such creatures you don't want to encounter. But then the paradigm shifted through additional information. Human beings began to realize that the earth is a sphere. And the effect was that exploration took off on an exponential level, and the whole world was explored through sailing. Another paradigm shift, even more significant, is that for thousands of years, human beings believed, they just assumed, without any question, that the basic paradigm for governmental structures is the divine right of kings. Through birth and inheritance, you come into power. But then the paradigm shifted, and human beings began to believe that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them the, and you know the rest of it. So the paradigm shifted. The United States of America is the result, literally, of a paradigm shift. A massive quantum change of informational base that then directed the actions of human beings to venture out in whole new territories of governmental structure. And it dawned on human beings that if all men are created equal and the divine right of kings is in fact not a basic truth or a basic reality, then what kind of governmental structure might we form? And emerged the United States of America. I tried to help a woman undergo a paradigm shift in India. I visited a small Hindu temple, and there at this particular temple, I saw a woman come in as I was looking at all of the worship paraphernalia that surrounded me. She came in and she was dumping money from a bag in front of the papier-mâché statue of the goddess Kali, the goddess of destruction. I leaned over. I don't know if you're supposed to whisper in these places, but I said, what exactly are you doing? And she said, why, I am making an offering to the goddess of destruction to avert tragedy that might come from her upon my life. And I leaned again and I said, what would you think if I told you that the one and only true God already loves you and means you no harm? She looked at me as if somebody had flipped a light on, and she could hardly believe it. When we were there in India, in Calcutta, we saw so many children with little bloated stomachs in the process of dying of starvation all over the streets. And so we inquired, how are these children cared for? And one of the people informed us they're not cared for at all. In fact, it would be a violation of our belief system because they are experiencing the result of bad karma. They have been reincarnated at this level to experience these particular pains and sufferings. And if we're to intervene and feed a hungry, starving child, we would be interfering with their karma and with God's will for them. And so that paradigm or that belief pans out in a set of values, a set of actions. We are motivated out of our belief systems. Now, a paradigm, it's a word that has really had only a recent existence among human beings. And a paradigm is basically a worldview. It is like a lens, I guess you could say, through which everything that we encounter is colored in a certain way. In other words, we process what we encounter in this world based on our most fundamental assumptions, our belief system, our paradigm. Every human being, without exception, is standing, as it were, at a window looking out over the world. You witness anything from a hurricane that strikes and takes many lives, to a brutal rape or murder, to a car wreck, to a war, to any list of tragic circumstances. And as you look out over the world and you witness both good and evil, you interpret what you see based on your basic paradigm, your basic window of observation, your basic worldview. There are assumptions that you bring to what you witness. Are you with me so far? Now, these assumptions that we bring not only cause us to see the world certain ways, but the assumptions that we bring then in turn, as I've already noted, have an effect upon the way we behave and act and relate to what we witness in the world. Now, with 6.5 billion people on the planet, you would think that there would be an endless array of possible worldviews or basic paradigms. Strangely enough, it all boils down to only about 5 paradigms or worldviews. You say, like one guy I met, he said, "No, I don't believe anything." Even if you can't articulate what you believe, you do believe something, and it is dictating the course of your life. Even if you can't wrap your words around it to explain it on an intellectual level, even if you don't have a systematic point by point, point one, point two, point three belief system, at least on an emotional level, you have a gut sense of what you think is going on in the world. And from that gut sense, on an emotional level, you live out of your emotional paradigm, even if it's not intellectually formed in such a way that you can explain. But we all believe something, and there are only about 5 basic worldviews. And I'm going to share with you in brief the first 4, and then I'm going to share with you the 5th worldview, which I will be spending the remainder of our time trying to persuade you of in this 7-part series. Worldview number 1, the most dominant worldview held by human beings, is what is referred to as classical theism. Say that out loud so you know what we're looking at right now. It is called what? Classical theism. Classical refers to the classical period of Roman Greek history. So that's where it's located historically. It's where the view emerges from. And theism refers to what? What is theos? God. So classical theism is a belief in God that is shaped by classical Roman Greek views. All right? Now, in classical theism, there are 2 branches. There is what we could refer to as pagan fatalism, and secondly, what we can refer to as Christian determinism. Follow this carefully now. Pagan fatalism. The Greek world was a pagan world with a multitude of different deities and gods. All right? And the Greeks believed in fate, hence fatalism. They believed in destiny. They believed that things happen, whatever they are, whether a death, a war, victory in a war, defeat in a war, any kind of brutality, any kind of good thing, any kind of bad thing, all of it is predetermined by the gods. And so when something happens to you, you had absolutely no contribution to the experience. Life happens to you. You do not yourself shape history, not even in your immediate context. Everything happens because it's all prescripted. The gods have written a novel, as it were, and you're a part of that novel. You're in chapter 19, let's say, and your little life has all been predetermined to take place before you ever got anything in your head that you thought you might want to do. So that even in the process of choosing to do certain things, you're not really choosing. So the Greeks would say that your choosing is an illusion. You think you're choosing what you're going to do. You're not. It was decided ahead of time by the gods. Everything is destiny. Everything is determined ahead of time. Now, Plato and Aristotle, they formed the foundation for this kind of thinking in pagan Greece. Plato put forth the idea that God is absolute being. Again, don't let that throw you. It just means that God is absolute in the ultimate sense, and that's all there is in the universe, is this one supreme absolute being, so that all of us, well, our very existence is an illusion. We're going on, as it were, in God's thought process. And then Aristotle came along, who was a student of Plato, and he said, well, he said, if God is absolute being, God is unmoved mover, meaning God is void of passion. He never enters into a relationship with anyone, because how can you enter into a relationship, let's see, with a vacuum cleaner or a microwave oven or a 69 Chevy? You can't enter into a relationship with something you fabricated or created that has no life of its own, no autonomy, no freedom. So we're puppets, as it were. We're machines that God has created, and we operate in that way. Now, Augustine came along, and he lifted that Greek philosophy and transported it into Christianity and developed what is known as sovereignty theology. And then Calvin came along, and he said, you know, if all this is true, then what else would be true? And this is where you'll begin to hear some familiarity. Well, if everything's predetermined, then every person's salvation or damnation is predetermined. And so he formed the idea of a predestination doctrine that says that God decides unilaterally who's saved and who's lost, and human beings have how much say in it? Absolutely none. God simply decides who's saved and who's lost. This is Christian determinism, or classical theism of the Christian historic strain, okay? Coming down to us through Greek and Roman philosophy, but then being Christianized with Christian information, terminology, and theological ideas. So that's worldview number one, classical theism. And that is held by a good 3.5 billion people in the world. Somehow, on some level, adhere to the idea that everything's a done deal, either by fate or by divine sovereignty. God unilaterally calls all the shots. Whatever happens is God's ultimate will. All right? That's one view. And you may be sitting there resonating in your heart a little bit and saying, wait a minute, I kind of believe that. My wife Sue and I met a guy on a cruise who believed it. After he had 7 piles of food and then topped off with 4 desserts perched on top of lime jello, His wife was so disgusted at the enormity of his caloric intake that she said to us, these were new acquaintances of ours on this particular journey, she said, "He's going to die. He's going to die. I know he's going to die. And then after he eats all of that, he's going to go out and have a cigarette." And he shrugged it off in fatalistic fashion by simply saying, as he piled it in, "I figure when it's my time to go, I'm going to go. And nothing I eat or don't eat is going to make a whit of difference. My time to die is my time to die, period." Then there is appeasement theism. Appeasement theism has been held down through the ages in various pagan religions, as well as transported into Christianity. And the basic idea in appeasement theism is that there is a god or gods, plural, the pagan version. And this god or gods are the kind of beings who can be and ought to be appeased. And that's why you encounter human sacrifice down through the ages in various cultures. That's why you encounter in certain religions pilgrimages and penance and confessional booths and prayers that go through a series of human mediators and the worship and veneration of Mary, through whom you might be able to soften God's heart. That's why you have in this world this notion that human beings can, by their actions, in most cases by actions of suffering, are capable of calming the wrathful heart of God and getting him to be positive toward me. That is appeasement theism. Human beings have the capacity through suffering to change the vengeful heart of God to become favorable toward us. And a lot of people in the world believe that that kind of God rules the universe. And then there is a third worldview, and it is called materialism. And usually it is associated with atheism. Materialism is not materialism in the sense of just loving to shop till you drop and acquire as many things as you possibly can before you die. Materialism in the scientific sense. The word materialism means that all there is what? Matter. The material that we encounter, the earth under our feet, the cosmos that surrounds us, it's all physical, and with enough observation and with enough travel and enough cameras and enough space transport, we can explore all of it and figure it all out. But there is no moral dimension to reality, and there is no spiritual dimension to reality. We live in a material universe, and in materialism, there is no God, whether an appeasable deity or not, whether a deterministic deity or not, just no God, period, at all. And so what is the reason for suffering in a world when you have a materialistic paradigm or worldview? If you are a materialist, you believe that suffering is natural. It's part of the process of the survival of the fittest, as postulated by Charles Darwin in the evolutionary theory. Every part of the natural world is kicking and clawing and scratching and biting to get to the top. And the survival of the fittest says that it is actually for the benefit of the natural world for brutality to take place so that the weakest strains of the species can die off. And then the stronger parts of the species can mate and produce a more superior form of life. That is the survival of the fittest mentality that emerges from materialism when reasoned through to its logical conclusion. The fourth worldview that is held by many people, probably 1.5 billion people on the planet approximately, believe in pantheism. You know what pan means, right? The cameras are panning. They're taking in the surrounding landscape, right? And theism, again, is God. Pantheism means all is God or God is all. There is no personal being anywhere in the universe who thinks and feels and performs or executes actions. Creation itself, nature itself, is all there is, and nature is deified in that worldview. Nature is worshipped in that worldview. And fifthly, there is what we're going to refer to as the warfare worldview, or with positive terminology, the benevolent maker worldview. This worldview we're going to explore in greater detail in our next six times together, because we will learn in this worldview that a paradigm or a window on the world develops that is extremely positive, although it is attended with pain. Rather than viewing all the evil in this world as the result of a deterministic God who unilaterally causes all things to happen, whether good or evil, rather than viewing the evil in this world as the result of natural selection with no God in the picture, rather than viewing the suffering in this world as the result of an appeasable deity who's getting his pound of flesh from these human beings that are so aggravating to him, rather than seeing a pantheistic worldview in which there really is no God of a personal nature, and again, suffering is natural to the process of development, such as in reincarnation, the benevolent maker worldview suggests that the suffering and evil that we encounter in this world is in fact the result of a cosmic conflict that is occurring between two opposing forces. And that cosmic conflict, sometimes called the great controversy between Christ and Satan, holds the secret to understanding why and how there could be evil and suffering in a world created by a good God. So that's the direction we're going to be launching in our next six times together. Please pray with me. Father in heaven, thank you for your word, which we are now prepared to move into in greater detail as we seek to understand what's happening in this world around us, so filled with pain and suffering and evil. May you be vindicated as we study your word. In Jesus' name, amen.